BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Five Lives Rugby Union Daily with Hugo Monier and Chris Jones.
Right, Rugby Union Daily, Six Nations Weekend 1 is in the can. And what an opening weekend, what a tournament. And Hugo, what a lineup we have for this definitive review of the opening round with our returning pod heroes, Sam Warburton and John Barkley, back in the house.
That's very generous, isn't it, Jonesy?
He's been on one all day, just to let you know.
No, I have not.
He's been on the rampage.
Would you not describe them as returning pod heroes?
One out of the two.
Well, there you go.
Okay.
I mean, I'll let the public decide.
So Hugo's on your case, John, is he?
Yeah, well, he wants to come up to Murrayfield in a few weeks, but he's got to smarten his act a bit once he gets there.
Because you have the right to refuse entry, don't you?
Want to come to my country? Come on.
So much to come. Is anyone stopping Ireland? How vulnerable are France? Will we see the first half Wales or the second half Wales at Twickenham this weekend? But first on the pod today, we start with some sad news. The death of the great Barry John at the age of 79, simply known as the King, one of rugby's first ever superstars, the fulcrum of that great Wales slam in 71, the even greater Lions win in New Zealand later that summer, and a man perhaps more than any who inspired a generation and made that Wales number 10 shirt so magical and mystical. So fitting we have another great Welsh 10 in Jiffy, Jonathan Davis, to pay tribute. How are you, Jiffy? Sad news, yeah. But put into context how great Barry John was.
Yeah, very sad. There's so many of them, JPR, Benny, David Watkins, they're all passing away now. It's very sad, but you don't get the nickname of the King, you know, if you're an average player. I just thought he was just such a stylish, graceful player, class act, on and off the field. He had always had time, you know, on the ball, on the field. And the good thing about, you know, growing up, I went to the same school as Barry, and so I knew about Barry at a young age. You know, his photos are everywhere, his legacy. And you bump into your heroes and you become their friends as well. So he was just, an amazing player, a rugby intellect, and I had many coffees with him, you know, discussing games. And even when I was playing, he'd sit down and tell me, you know, how to improve my game, what I should work on. So, yeah, it's very, very sad news. A great, great player.
Jeff, I just want to pick you up on that bit about following him in that Wales 10 shirt and what he meant. But Sam, for a sort of a player who played recently for Wales in the last 10 years, the name Barry John just was so enduring in Welsh rugby folklore, wasn't it? Even though his great moments were 50 years ago, they were still so enduring, felt so fresh, and will be enduring for many decades to come.
Yeah, I mean this in the most respectful way to, and I don't mean the lads playing, I mean like even when I was playing as well, a lot of those guys that Jiffy mentioned, Barry being one of them, are almost more recognisable now than some of the guys who are arguing, than some of the guys who are playing. It's just, you can't live in Wales, well, I'm sure it's worldwide in the rugby world, but in Wales, they're names that you just can't avoid. Just absolute heroes for so many people. And I've been at charity events with these guys, and I've seen 60-year-old men like in tears at the fact that they've met their heroes 40 years after they finished playing. I mean, the sort of legacy that they've left Welsh rugby. And you know when you pick up that shirt that you're sort of following in the footsteps of those greats of the 70s, and there's so much history there. So, yeah, it is it's a tragic loss for Welsh rugby. And in Wales, and you know, Chris, as a secret Welshman, there's just so much admiration for him and all the other sort of fellas of the 70s. It's quite sad to, as Jiffy said, you know, even going back to Mervyn Davis going back a few years ago. It's quite a sad realisation now of the age that they're at, but what they've given to Welsh rugby and the sort of place they've left it in for generations like Jiffy's, like myself, and inspired us to play the game will never be forgotten.
And Jiffy, was it as, you know, he achieved, you know, a huge amount. You know, 71 was the first slam since 52. That would have been a huge moment in Welsh rugby, almost 20 years wait for the slam. And 71, the Lions, you know, it still is an incredible achievement given it's never been replicated. But was it as much how he did it as what he did? You know, the ball in two hands, the attacking style, the grace, the gliding, the genius.
That was a difference. You always get compared to, you know, previous players, and it was always Phil Bennett and Barry John. But Benny was the jinking genius, you know, he'd step and run. And then, as you said, Barry was just graceful, gliding everywhere. The tries you'll see, on television now. You know, against England, against Scotland, just beautifully beating people with balance and poise, with the ball in both hands. And then, you know, again, with the, when he went down to beat the All Blacks, you know, that was a great side with great names. But he was the one that came away with, you know, the nickname the King, how he controlled the game when he needed to drop goals. He, you know, you put them over. His game management was absolutely brilliant. And, yeah, he was just, you know, he packed in at 27. So did we see the best of him? Who knows? But, you know, what we saw of him was truly a genius of rugby.
The nickname the King. I mean, yeah, that exactly. Literally just says it all. I mean, we live in a generation where we have such a media presence as well as a social media presence, and we try to manufacture these superstars of the modern game. But without all of that broadcasting, without the TV, the radio, social media, all the rest of it, how his name and his legacy and his talent has stood the test of time, 50 years plus, where people do look upon the players who are playing the game today, but are also so deeply connected to the likes of Barry John. I think that in itself is just so remarkable and tells you everything that you need to know about a talented player that, as Jiffy just said there, retired before the age of 30.
And Jiffy, on that era, you know, you just had to say Barry, didn't you? Or Gareth, or JPR. You
know, we were, you know, at the ground yesterday, and the tributes that went out for, you know, five players who had passed, previous past players who had passed since Wales's last game. And, you know, JPR came up, and then it was just, they did a video of JPR on Scrum 5 today, and it was absolutely brilliant piece. And it just, you know, JPR, Gerald, Barry, Merv, it's all by their first names, you know. So, and as Sam said, you go into the Welsh change room and you have to take a breath and think of the names that have gone before you and hope you leave the jersey in a better place. And I walked into a grammar school when I was 11 years of age, and the outside halves on the wall were Carwin James, Barry John and Gareth Davis. So no real pressure on you as 11
so,
year-old.
So was it more pressure or inspirational?
You know, if you've got any talent as a kid, I think there's always pressure there. But you know, I think it's in Wales, the number 10 jersey. And you know, again, with Sam and Martin Williams, the number 7 jersey lately. But there's always pressure there and the focus is on there. But for me, having grown up, you know, in West Wales, 10 miles away from Barry, where Barry was born, you know, 5 miles away from where Benny was born. They're an inspiration because I watched them play, you know, week in, week out. So I just was very, very lucky to grow up watching these boys play.
And just finally, Jiff, you mentioned there he retired at 27, and the story goes, but I think he confirmed that it was when a cashier curtsied at him at the opening of a bank that he went, well, this is all a bit much. I am not literally the King. So it never sat too comfortably with him, did it? The fame, the adulation and the, you know, the profile.
He was such, you know, quite an assuming guy. You know, I used to meet up and, you know, have a beer with him and his brothers, you know, early on in my career. And he just was a normal bloke who just wanted to keep a low profile. Unfortunately, you know, that didn't happen because of how great he was on the field. So he just didn't want it. And it was sad because I, you know, I didn't see enough of him play and I'd love to have seen a lot more of him. But, you know, as I said, I sat with him on numerous occasions and he was a rugby intellect. And when he spoke, you know, I learned so much from him just when I played and in my broadcasting after. So imagine if he was around and playing these days, you know, the adulation and the, you would have got from on social media and everything. Just ridiculous. And if you mention all those names in the, you know, the 71 Lions side, and, you know, he was the one, as Hugo said, came back. And I think maybe the New Zealanders call him the King.
Yeah, they did.
So, you know, to get that kind of admiration.
Respect
from
on that side of the world,
nation,
yeah.
Respect, yeah. You know, because he was the one who orchestrated that great side to victory in 71.
Great words, Jeff. Thanks so much for joining us.
Cheers, boys. Thanks, boys. Catch up soon.
Cheers.
Good stuff. Jonathan Davis on Barry John. And I mean, if this isn't too crude a segue, guys, you know, the game on Saturday almost had, you know, was such a ridiculous contrast before and after halftime. And after halftime, it was almost like Wales roll back the decades a bit. And away went the tactical kicking. And away went the, you know, the game plan and the trying to do everything by the coaching book, and they just played in that second half, almost a bit like Barry John and his ilk would have done back in the 70s.
I think Welsh lads, like, they've had a bit of a stereotype maybe over the last 10 years about playing really physical, but Welsh lads by nature and growing up love to throw the ball around, you know, like love to play that type of rugby. So,
well, they're natural ballers, Sam, aren't they?
Yeah, Welsh well, players. I'm not, but the other players are. But you love to pass the ball around. That's what rugby is growing up in Wales. It's not the sort of slugfest of mauls and kicks when you're playing at schoolboy level coming through. It is about, and it's probably like, it's still rippled down and it's still passes through generation to generation to play. And it probably stems all the way back going to particularly those boys from the 70s. But, you know, it's been maybe a criticism of Wales in the past. I mean, in the recent past, that it takes them to go down to be able to sort of cut the shackles off and then actually throw the kitchen sink at the opposition. They don't rarely do Wales start a game like that. It often takes, because when you are down, if you're down by 20 points or 27 points and you try something and you lose, it's not a big a deal as when it's 0-0 at the start of a game where people expect so much. You know, so they try more when they're down because sort of there's less risk, I guess, or the perception of less risk. So that's the only criticism, I think, of Wales. They need to start better at Twickenham. At home, you might be able to come back against Scotland, which they obviously didn't quite do. But you do that at Twickenham. You know, Wales haven't won there since 2012. You're not coming back from 25 points in Twickenham. You know? So it's have to start better for sure.
Have to start better. You're absolutely right, Jonesy. What a fascinating game. And if you take the two halves in isolation, I look at Scotland and how brilliant they were in that first half, taking their opportunities, the sense of control they had, the dominance they got up front. That was excellent. Then mentally switching off in that second half. That happens. That can happen. I'm sure we've all been involved in games where mentally feels if the job is done and you switch off for 10% and the other team goes up by 10%. And that 20% margin or void manifests itself in you wrestling and becoming desperate to try and get momentum back. I'm not too concerned about that, but it does need to be addressed for Scotland. But Wales' performance in the first half, that's just not a mental switch off. That was alarming. I mean, the lineup at 50%, you don't win test matches like that. So I'm more concerned for Wales in their inability to be able to play rugby than any mental frailty that Scotland have. And I guess my question off the back is, and you touched upon it, but we've seen this trend for a number of years now in the Six Nations. And you're right, you throw the kitchen sink at stuff when you are trying to get yourself back in the game. But why does it feel as if, especially in this tournament, where Wales finally show a sense of desperation when you've literally hit the bottom of the well? And that can't be a motivating factor to then start playing, start showing some cohesion, start showing some desperation, start showing some physicality. Your baseline has to be way better than that.
I look at it, and it was the first game last year, and they were 20 points down at halftime again against Ireland. Same scenario. I feel a little bit sorry for Gareth Davis and Sam Costello, because it looked like they were just doing what they'd been told and what they'd practiced. Because you're 1 minute into the game, you're on Scotland's 10-metre line, and your first attacking chance, the stadium's alive, the best stadium in the world. And what do you do? You box kick it. You know,
with no chase.
And that's fine.
A negative collision, you know, and with a long kick.
And then
everything was wrong about it.
And I get you, the kicking game is so important. It is, of course. We talk about it all the time, and the best teams actually usually kick the most. But when they get into attacking halves, they come to life. And I just thought at the very start of the game, this is a new generation, this is a new group of players, loads of uncapped guys, new captain, start at the Six Nations, and you kick the ball away. And Costello did it a couple of times. And you sense the stadium just kind of drain a little bit. And then, to me, that's playing not to lose. And you're coming out here thinking, we're not really sure, but we can chase the ball loads, we can put the ball in the air, we can pressurise Scotland. But it didn't work. And you saw in the second half, yeah, Scotland's discipline was terrible, but you saw the accuracy they can play with. The speed, tempo, skills, all the stuff you spoke about, Warby.
But you get given a game plan, and maybe when you're less experienced, and Gareth Davis isn't inexperienced, by the way, he's a very experienced player, but you get given a game plan, and you know for a fact, this is what Gats would have been saying at half-time, like, look, lads, there's a game plan, but if you see something, then play. It doesn't mean you have to only do that kick option. Mm. Have a look to see if there's space, and go into your point of view, about starting slow. I think it's a mentality thing. Like, it's people always wonder why you start. Like, I hated as a player when people were like, oh, Wales were great in defeat, heroic losers, and they would come back from behind. And I was like, no, that's a losing mentality. Like, you've got to go out to a game and assert yourself and expect to win. Don't be surprised when you win and walk off as if it's no bother and you're going to rock up and do the same again next week. So I always hated the like, and that's why even now, I can swallow it now because it's a young group and I thought the resilience to bounce back was actually great. Another young group of players from another team could have absolutely crumbled 27 down and it could have gone to 40-50. So I was actually really pleased to see that resilient side. But, and look, I haven't been in teams like this my whole career. Very few times I've been in teams like this. So I don't have the privilege of experiencing this often. But when you are in a good team, excuse a sort of blunt analogy, but it's, the mentality is kill or be killed. Like you go out, first 5 minutes, you're ruthless in contact area, you're ruthless in everything you do. And that hasn't happened many times to me, but when you're in a team like that, it feels brilliant. And that's a mentality thing. You don't go out and be like, oh, let's see what the opposition have got. You go out and you assert yourself. And I remember talking to players like before games. I'd be like, right, the first three contacts you have, whether it's a carry, whether it's a ruck clean, whether it's a high ball take, you dominate. You absolutely dominate. And, I only realised this because I played New Zealand once. And they absolutely dominated us in every aspect for the first 5 minutes. And I remember thinking, wow, they're on it. So I thought, right, I got to flip that. And I need to make sure that whatever team I'm in, we have that same impact on the opposition. I think Wales, I guess to sum it up really, make sure you throw the first punch. You know, don't wait to be punched and then try and react. You know, they've got to have a mindset where they're going out to throw the first punch and they should expect to win. So I think it's a mentality type of
thing. John, we probably should be talking about Scotland first, given that they actually did win the game, the first one in Cardiff in 22 years. But Sam, are Wales, like, did Gatland set the team up at the start to play a classic Gatland template, which always used to have Dan Biggar at 10, Liam Williams in the air? You were physical, you know you'd be able to win an arm wrestle, you'd get Scotland to 60, the Cardiff factor would kick in, you'd edge the game. But they're doing that without the tools. It has the second half, going to give Gatland serious food for thought that he might have to try and get some belief and confidence in these young guys to play a completely different style to maybe any Welsh team of the last 10 years?
I think that's the challenge. I think you just said it there, Chris. It's not really the tactical side of things, it's the belief and confidence. And I'm kind of smirking because I've been in so many dressing rooms and team meetings where Gats probably takes the brunt of it for like, oh, he set them up to be just pragmatic and only kick. And like, he'll always say, lads, if you want to play though, play. They'll start off training, playing like sort of seven-a-side games to encourage throwing the ball around and to encourage speed of ball and play into space. So it's like, yes, there's a game plan, but if you see something's on, like, please go for it. I give you the license to play. So I feel the coach might come under some criticism. And look, I remember as a player put my hand up going, look, we're not willing to take risks. Sometimes the player's got to take it on board. It's hard to take a risk when you're playing at home in front of 75,000 people, but that comes with experience. Hopefully that experience now, they will go, right, we can't let that happen again, you know? So yeah, Gatland does play pragmatic, but he will give him a license to play.
But it's poor messaging then. Maybe. Because if all you've done is drill in, gain line, kick chase, work rate, all the rest of it, then the message of play what you see, and if there are opportunities, that's been lost. That's been lost. Yeah. That's been submerged by the overriding emotion and philosophy of this is what we do. And the game plan I saw, and I know it's already been said, is to constrict and restrict the opposition from scoring points. But there's not enough emphasis of how we get at it. I guess the tough thing is because every team and the best teams have an identity. We saw that from Ireland. That's not changed. We're so well adept at knowing what they're about. Whether they win or lose, New Zealand, South Africa, exactly the same. If the philosophy or the foundation for Wales coming into it was physicality, kick chase, work rate, all those things that have been synonymous with Warren Gatland and high-performing, high-functioning teams. If after game one, that's gone, and you're now saying, oh, lads, no. We want to retain that because every team needs to retain that, but we want to be a pass-first team rather than kick-first team. All of the messaging over the last few weeks and the planning as to how you think you'll be successful has been undone because of 40 minutes of rugby. So was it really ever a foundation at all? So I'm fascinated to see how they approach this game at Twickenham, 100%. Which is massively different. You're playing away from home where you've just got to be aware of history. 22 years it's taken Scotland to get a win. I mean, I was 8 the last time. No, I wasn't. But, 22 years, no one bit at it, fair enough. So I'll be really interested to see what the first 15, 20 minutes of Twickenham, how they set up first. Because everyone has a plan A and then you have to resort to a plan B if plan A is not working. I would love plan A for Wales to be their plan B they showed at the Principality on Saturday.
Just finally on Wales, it was amazing. it was a bit of the second half where Thomas Williams shapes the box kick and then he dummies, goes open, Winnett skins, I think it was Turner, puts Dyer away. No teams try that unless they need to in Test rugby. You guys will play Test rugby. Maybe this is a bit of a sort of idealistic approach, but if the game is tight or in the first half, every team would box kick in that situation. So rare would they actually see if it's on, and it was on, and they made 50, 60 metres and scored.
Ireland would.
Do you reckon, so do you think the real best teams have that belief and confidence to always have a look?
It's communication. So you know how to set up for a box kick. And I'll tell you what, as a winger, the minute I see a caterpillar ruck being positioned, my whole back three, we change, we get into position. In fact, I might be calling back a number eight, might get four in the back, waiting for that kick to come. So if you're seeing that as an attacker, the person with the ball, when you're in possession of the ball, if there's space on the edge, go one, two passes, maybe bring some up, then kick. You still might end up kicking, but what you're doing is not just physically stressing aside, you're also mentally stressing them instead of being predictable. And Thomas Williams, I thought he made such a big difference. Mm. And of course, when you're winning gain line, Gareth Davis would have looked just as good because you're getting speed of ball and more opportunities, more variety, and there's a greater appetite to play. The best teams mentally stress teams and don't constantly, repeatedly show them the same picture.
I just think you look at the way they played and you look at that game plan, that structured game, kick the ball, chase the ball, a pressure-based game is what it looked like. And I don't think, and I'm not being disparaging, and I don't think any other teams have the player profile to it apart from South Africa.
And because, France, maybe.
And well, maybe. That, but huge men, big scrum, maul. Great in the air. And Wales have got a young team, great athletes, but not a big power game. So, you know, we saw when they got down there, you know, the start there, and they kind of, it was a bit slow, a bit lethargic. And I think, actually, to your point, Luke, that plan B is probably more of that hybrid. You got to kick the ball, you got to chase the ball, but actually come alive and have that mentality and mindset and be urgent before you get desperate.
I spoke to Sir Kalisa about this before the World Cup and he says, if you want a high kick
first
pressure
drop.
Game... If you want a high kick pressure game, there's two things you absolutely
you
need
here?
To have certainty. No, we were just hanging out.
Just
chilling. You need to know that you have 100% knowledge and quality output in your scrum. Because if you win the ball back, someone knocks it on, well, you're going to get to set piece. So you need to be guaranteed that you're going to win the ball back of a scrum. Or you win penalties off tap backs and all the rest of it, and then you probably go to line out. So unless your line out's high functioning, you know you're going to get a positive result out of it, or you get tap backs, knock-ons, and you need to go to a scrum, there's no point, but you have a far greater output. Because don't forget, when you choreograph how you want to build your way up the pitch, kicking's a big part of that. What do you do next? If you're going to get more set pieces because there's going to be more mistakes and the game's going to be a little bit stop-start, you have to be guaranteed that you have a set piece that functions well, the line-out. And by the way, for Wales to come back in that manner with barely a line-out, hit and miss a little bit at the scrum, remarkable comeback. But as for Scotland, and we've barely spoken about them, and it was Scotland that won, and got history done in a place. The way they played in that first half was sensational. Finn Russell and the headlines and the amount of words that have been spoken about him in the build-up to it. Give that guy time and space and he will show his true quality. He was a genius at the weekend. 50-22, the controlling of the game, assisting for tries. We talk about spotting space and playing to it. He does that so well. And his fall of Tuipulotu, because he is such a threat at the line himself, he just gives a fraction bit more time and space to a player that needs no time and space to be able to create those magic moments.
I think my biggest criticism of Scotland, probably the World Cup, was the, I'd call it a stubbornness, to change their style and to keep playing and playing and playing. And
arrogance.
Well, that's what I'd say about you, but we're talking about Scotland. We've had a lot of this today.
Didn't ever get Scotland rugby called arrogant.
Yeah, exactly. You get out your ivory tower over there. What was I saying? First scrum of the game, and I'm thinking, please, please be direct. And first scrum of the game, give the ball to Tuipulotu straight over Costello, because he is, I put him in the same profile. He's not as good as Bundiaki yet, but that player that can carry like an absolute horse can distribute. His handling for the try was superb. Mm. He's actually got a really good short kicking game as well. And he has given Finn so much more time on the ball. Ben White as well. I think he was, talk about, I don't think it's not, it wasn't far from perfect first half. Ben White's kicking the ball, one phase, kicked the ball out on the halfway line, pressured the line out. Defence was good, physical. We actually didn't see a huge amount of Finn because they only had one red zone entry in the second half. But the times he had the ball, he looked good. He looked bloody good.
What I liked about Finn was actually his post-match interview. And you know when you've given up such a big scoreline like that, the easy thing to be is like, oh yeah, Wales played so well in the second half, which is kind of the gracious thing to do. Kind of just stay away from maybe the errors you made. I quite like that he just admitted. I always say to people, honesty is what we want in post-match interviews. He just went, yeah, we were complacent. Like they probably got the 27 points and thought, yeah, job done. But I think it's a good learning for Scotland. They got away with it with the skin of their teeth, but they'll know next time when they're away from home and they're 20 points up or 25 points up, they'll be like, job's not done. You know, the job is never done. The top teams just keep going and keep going. So I really like this honesty post-match. They were great first half. They'll learn from this and they'll become even more ruthless, you hope, from it.
Do you think now, considering the poverty of their performance in the second half, sets them up perfectly mentally to be laser-focused with France in town this weekend?
I think it's the best thing that could happen to them. Mm. And because they got away with it. Mm. Yeah. And will they rue the no bonus point? Who knows? But I totally agree. I think if the game had kind of just petered around and they'd maybe scored a try or hadn't, and it kind of just gone back and forth, actually that laser focus around... If we're off it, and you've got France coming to town who are not going to be, you're not going to be happy. We've got to be well on. And actually, to your point on Finn, he is the most relaxed guy. We've all spoken to him, very aloof, very jovial. That's probably the angriest I've ever seen him. Like visibly, really frustrated.
You like that though?
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. Because I think he's the kind of cat, and we ask all the time about the captaincy and is it a good thing and a bad thing and what would he be like as a captain? And I think probably last year we'd been like, oh, it's fine, we won and we'll have a beer and we'll build next week. He was really frustrated with that game and really frustrated with how they let Wales back into that game.
We don't see much of that, guys. In the modern day post-match interviews from modern day players, maybe because they don't want any negativity to seep into the camp or they want to do it behind closed doors. But Finn was calling people out and that's you don't see that as much as you might think these days. I'm sure you don't.
I think that's quite powerful, especially from him. As someone
100%, I think it's
great.
Rare.
I think that as someone that probably is that lighthearted character, for someone like him to be like, we're saying things and we're still doing the things that we're saying not to do, and it's players and it's individuals, and it's quite refreshing because everyone knows that. And you get asked, I got asked, you know, that 2010 game has been mentioned a couple of times because it felt like that kind of game, and how do you stop that happening? And it's players making mistakes. You can say all the things you want and it's like, oh, you're giving away another penalty. The captain doesn't control that. It's the player who do it and the players who make mistakes control that. So I think their review will probably be almost a review of two halves. They'll look at the first half, say great, second half, they'll be like, what the hell was that?
Sam, I mean, you've always been very honest, broadcasting as well as a captain and a player. Would you have gone as far as calling people out after a second half like that and the way Finn did?
Yeah, no, I'll be honest, like... I wouldn't. I don't think I was honest in post-match interviews, but I wouldn't call somebody out publicly. No, I wouldn't do that. But I know this from learning the hard way. Like I don't say this from like sitting on my armchair like I never got this wrong. I say it because I made the same mistakes that Scotland made when you're complacent. And I remember when there was that 2013 game against England. I don't mean to bring it up, but I remember the final score we got. But going back to halfway line, it wasn't boys celebrating. It was boys like looking at each other as if you're only 1 point down, like, right, now we go. We've got to close it out, even though you're 27 points in the lead. And that took probably like 6 defeats to Australia in a row to get to that point, you know, when you just go through so many bad moments. So, yeah, I was honest. I never really called out players personally. I'd always rather do that behind closed doors.
I don't think Finn did name names, though, did he?
Yeah.
He just said, look, as a group, we weren't good enough for people making errors. Yeah.
But I agree with what John said, though. Like, you know, there's nothing as a team you can kind of say in those moments. You just need 15 players to step up and do it. And like, as an example, you know, there's loads of like hype made around the roof being open or closed. And as a Welsh person, like, when someone's coming to town, like, oh, we want to open, then I'm like, oh, that's a sign of weakness, you know, because they want it, they know about the atmosphere. I was sat next to Martin Johnson at the doing the BBC stuff, and I tapped him. I was like, mate, I bet you couldn't care less whether the roof was open or closed. He's like, mate, we said, do whatever you want. That's much more of a power play to be like, do what you want. We don't care. We're coming here to win. And like, you can imagine if you got 23 people of that mentality who just go there on a pitch, do a job, stop worrying about momentum, just play the game and be ruthless at what you do. That's kind of what you need to be like in that moment.
Awesome stuff. Right, loads more to come as Ireland lay down a marker in Marseille. That is all to come after this.
Pep Guardiola.
A perfectionist.
A tactical genius.
The best manager of his generation.
The best manager in history.
Reserve team coach Pep Guardiola, a popular former player at the Nou Camp, will take over from Rijkaard.
This is a podcast all about the man who has shaped the modern game.
It feels almost as if he's solved the riddle, if he's cracked the code for football.
From his history in La Masia to dominating football across Europe.
He's brought a brand of football to the Premier League that we've never seen before.
Everybody plays like Pep's teams now.
From football, he takes you to heaven.
From BBC Five Life.
Sporting giants, Pep Guardiola.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Right, who's stopping Ireland?
First of all, who thought Ireland would win in Marseille at the weekend?
Not me.
No,
not
I me. Thought France would win, yeah.
I thought France were going to win well.
CJ, yeah, I got a one for you. You might know as the rugby oracle. When was the last time, and I'm putting you on the spot here, maybe this is more common than not. When was the last time that there was three away wins in a Six Nations round? It doesn't happen often. I can't think of it off the top of my head. It's a stat that hasn't really come out.
Do you know what? I think it's more recent than you might think.
I don't know.
I can't get off the top of my head.
Yeah, no worries.
It's interesting because I didn't think Ireland would win in France. But the amount of Irish who are now telling me after the event that they thought they were going to win because they're all very quiet before the match. Unbelievable, professional, ruthless job that they did.
I just thought it was being in Marseille that France would be, look to the French team, look to the crowd, the atmosphere was incredible, Sexton missing, all this. I was convinced France would win, but then one of the French journalists, Arnaud David, really experienced French journalist, he had a face as long as a fiddle in the press room before the game, and I was like, well, you're going to win this. And he went, I've got a problem at lock, I'm not sure about the locks. Williams got sent off. I think we'll struggle without Dupont. I was like, oh, okay. And then he said, I'm not sure about Murfana on the wing. So he literally just like was like, he's like, I'm really worried about it. And that was the first time that I even contemplated that France would win this game. That's not to disparage Ireland; they're brilliant. I just thought in Marseille, World Cup backlash. I saw the French team on paper. You put all that in. You saw the crowd, the anthems for Ireland to do what they did. It was one of the great Six Nations wins, really.
Yeah, I just thought, I don't take anything away from it. I think Ireland were probably in about 6 out of 10, as in how much more they've got to their ceiling. I think France were probably about a 3 out of 10. And I was so disappointed by just the energy, probably more than anything. We spoke about Wales in the first half, a lack of energy. And I think this French team has been typified under Sean Edwards, under this really aggressive, this work rate, a desire to work and jackal and compete, and there was none of that. It was really lethargic, and the tries were great, and especially you look at the Gibson Park try, it looks like great, and it is good play. It's also really bad defence. The Tadhg Byrne try is really bad defence, but that's what Ireland do. It's very easy, bad defence, and it was bad defence, but Ireland are the best team at exerting pressure, I think, and squeezing and squeezing, and the detail in their game, especially when you're under pressure, makes you make bad decisions.
Just to back up what you're saying, and we can't, I don't listen to think, oh, it's Dupont, you know. No. Oh, it's not right. It's deeper than that, because I look at my breakdown Norsey stats, which I love, and I bored you boys with a bit of this today, but talking of effort in defence, right, France are a team who, because I look at these every time teams play, they'll compete at more than 50% of rucks in defence. So, like, on average, 50 to 60% of rucks.
The most turnovers in the Six Nations last year.
Yes, more than every other ruck, they're just in there making a mess. This week was, like, one in every three. So, like, that's a massive drop-off. And when you consider that there's 150 defensive rucks, that's a big drop-off in efforts and D. And we saw, we watched them, like, there was the two Irish tries. One was only a two-phase try, but one was a nine-phase try. Only one of those 10 phases was more than 3 seconds. So, like, Ireland are getting, and they average 2 seconds on average on those 10 phases. No one's going in competing. Like, where's the hunger in D, you know? And that's where I'm not questioning Sean. These are the things that Sean will be questioning the players. And they're going back, what are you doing? Where's your defensive efforts? Where's your work rate? So it just didn't seem to be there. Is it because they've come from this decrescendo off a World Cup cycle? They haven't got something to build towards. I don't know, but it did look unusually flat.
They did.
It was like they weren't over it.
Yeah, they did look really flat. And we'll touch upon Ireland there, brilliant. But there's two ways you slow ball down or win ball back in defence. And that's A, physicality, and they've got a lot of big boys and you win that battle, or B, you do it on the floor. And by the way, if you win the physicality battle, you can get on the floor. They didn't really win either one of those two, which is just so unlike France. You hope it's an anomaly for them, but they look so off colour. And by the way, a lot of them looking off colour was because of how brilliant Ireland were. But they're the best multi-phase team on the planet, I truly believe so. They only made two handling errors in the match. Talk about pressure and consistent pressure, as well as their ability to be able to put you under pressure in your half. So you're playing a lot of rugby out of your half. They were poor. You're going to have to let me finish when I say the next bit. They've got an issue at nine. I really believe so. We know Antoine Dupont's not here. Luku's a top quality operator. Him and Jalibert at Bordeaux are the business, and we've seen how brilliant they've been in Vestic Champions Cup. But Luku, he doesn't offer a lot, if not little, around the fringes. And when you've got a highly aggressive, dominant defence like Ireland, you cannot have a nine that just picks the ball up and passes. You can't. You have to challenge around the fringes. He didn't do it. It wasn't until they replaced their nine and brought on
Legarac. He was actually good when he came out.
And I thought, he's running with the ball.
Yeah, he looked
dynamic. He's challenging the first, second, third defender, which put Ireland on their heels just a little bit. But you can't have a nine who just catches. I mean, we're literally going back to a nines play from 10, 20 years ago. You can't. You're just lining up big lads and run into a brick wall. Run into another one. They're not giving away penalties. So how do you create momentum? So I'll be really interested when they go up to Scotland this weekend and whether they start Lagerac, who been sensational at Racing and probably a bit more attuned to playing the way France want to play, to occupy the position and the style that Dupont has put in place. And you can't replace the best player in the world. But stylistically, Lagerac fits that mould way better than Luku for me.
Sam, in answer to your question, it's so rare three away teams winning that we only had it twice last year.
Yeah, I know. One of the guys just went to me. One of the guys, Owen, who's here, just went, Sam, it's first weekend of last year.
And the fourth, and yeah, the fourth no weekend. Yeah.
Good start. Good
and
start.
Then it happened the year before as well.
Yeah, get out of here, Sam.
but can someone answer the question, who's stopping Ireland?
Look, I got their fixture list here. They're home to Italy. I think we're all pretty unanimous in which way that goes. Home to Wales. Very likely they're going to win that one. Away to England. I always think, though, England, when England turn it on, that'll be difficult.
But you're about to tip England there, because you're in a nod, which doesn't work so well on a podcast.
Okay. Oh, yeah, where do you think? Yeah.
I think their biggest challenge is England at Twickenham.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's their only next away game.
We've not touched upon England. We'll speak about them, and people will measure where Ireland were against France, against where England were against Italy. And by the way, worlds apart in terms of performance and output. Five tries away at Marseille versus two tries away in Rome. Incomparable. The context is, we know England are traditionally poor starters. It's the first win in round one of the Six Nations for 5 years. They will get better. They'll have the likes of, I thought Ollie Lawrence was missing. We're talking about England now, let's not. But Ireland, I think that's going to be a massive game. And it's a game that England will target and could still win.
If England defend like they defended against Italy, Ireland could put a load of points on them. With the detail in their attacking game, I think England got out of jail a little bit.
Okay.
Because, Sam, that's Ireland, isn't it? And individuals don't make Ireland. The structure, the shape, the pattern makes Ireland. You take Matt Hanson out, Calvin Nash does a job, take out Sexton, Crowley does a job. There are a few players who are really influential.
Ryan McCarthy comes in.
Yeah, and then they've got them coming off the bench. Exactly. And then they've still got Baird, Ryan Coden all on the bench. But they looked as if the World Cup hasn't changed what they're about, where it may have done France. It may have changed what France are about mentally and tactically. And they're all thinking, how can we play so well against South Africa and still lose? Ireland have probably seemed to, Sam, have compartmentalised the New Zealand loss and gone, look, what we're doing is still really good. Let's just keep doing it and doing it better.
Yeah, it is. That New Zealand game, like they'll obviously be gutted. That doesn't mean that that's 4 years of hard work just completely out the window. Like they put in so much effort into building the team they are. They're not just going to reinvent the wheel now. We've seen it with Leinster, not just for the last season, for the last five, six, seven, since I can remember, to be honest, the most seamless team. They can change their 23 and they just know the system, you know. I just think it looks so comfortable for Irish players just to slot in, and that's credit to Farrell, to the environment that he's created. But like someone like Crowley, who stepped in, I thought was you wouldn't have known any different if they were all just green shirts with no numbers and no faces. it was just a seamless.
Bondiaki didn't have a number for most of the game.
It just fits. It just fits. They all completely get the game plan, and there's not many teams like that in World
Cup. Do you know, we often talk about Ireland because it's the most obvious superpower that they have. But my word, the job, I've spoken about it so many times, the job Simon Easterby is doing there in defence.
He doesn't get enough.
And no one ever talks about it.
I know.
It's bizarre.
We interviewed Andy Farrell just the other week, and he's not in a rush to name his coaching staff, but Simon Easterby has to be your defence. Simon Easterby has to be your defence coach.
Because unless they want him to succeed Farrell and so give him the experience of being a number one. That's
the number one there. Because their ability to attack takes so much pressure off their defence. Because, say, for example, you conceded 4 tries a game and then you convert a couple of those. Your attack needs to be better than 24 points. That's what it is. But when your defence is limiting teams to just 2 tries a game, like, wow, you can express yourself, you can get after it. Their defence is so good. It might even be better with their attack, but the two in tandem, and it's very rare you actually see teams at the highest level who have such an outstanding attack, set piece so dominant, and the defence is brilliant. In every pot, every fundamental tool that you need to be this team as a whole, Ireland have it.
The only issue is their scrum, because France went to town on their scrum. But I don't see another really big scrummaging team this Six Nations.
Mate, France will create an issue for every team in the world with their scrum.
So Ireland have won by miles against France when their scrum was being taken apart largely. But I don't see, if that is one Achilles heel, I don't see any other team in the competition necessarily who have a destructive scrum that could take Ireland out.
And then their line-out, they kick to the corner. I mean, do you know when it's... You read a towel or you watch a move and you just know how it's going to end. When Ireland kick the ball 5 metres out and it's a driving ball, you're like, oh, well, this is going to be
Power play for them was when they could have taken the three towards the end of the game. They already had the bonus point. They could have taken the three just to 100% make sure that even if France did run the length and score 7 points, they still wouldn't get, they would deny France a bonus point loss. So that's probably what I was thinking. Oh, let's just make sure that France just can't even get a bonus point in defeat. But they already had a bonus point, and they were just like, on my point of like just being ruthless and when your foot's on the throat, you go again. They went, no, we go for the corner. And they just went for the corner and got a 5th try. I was just like, oh,
I actually think that the mauls were probably the single most concerning thing from a France point. Because I think you learn there's a lot of...
Is that where Phillips are missing John's a factor? Because he's out
I
the
think
game
so,
for most
but
of
you,
it.
It's the manner, how easy they went over. And that's a man test. That's a mentality, a psychology, a thing we've seen from this French team. And I don't know if the towel was thrown in, but certainly that last one was, and the speed with which they went over, the lack of intent, physicality, anything. You're at home at Marseille. It's the first game of Six Nations. Fight, and it just was lacking. So Willems was missed, and I think there was big hopes for him coming back in. His presence, he's that big, heavy ball carrier, destructive tackler. He didn't get it right the weekend, but I think that up front they were really outthought and outclassed and outmuscled.
France, the last couple of years, they lose a player in the bin and you still see the fight. The lack of effort, that's really harsh to say about an international player.
Intensity, isn't it?
It's intense.
But the lack of intensity was a throwback to the stereotypical type of France that we perhaps became accustomed to seeing 10, 15 years ago. Oh, it's getting a little bit tough. The game's over. And of course, massive credit to Ireland because they suffocated them. They got them to mentally and physically play that game at altitude. There was no breathing space, no breathing room at all for France to be able to catch a breath and get back into it. They just weren't allowed to.
Do you think this goes back a bit further to there was that first few rounds of Europe and first couple of rounds and we were looking at it and it was only really Toulouse, but it was La Rochelle lost both games, Racing lost both their games. Is there a bit, do you think there's a bit of like the players just been on this carousel for so long and Aldrit had that kind of mini sabbatical, then he'd come back and he's bouncing.
He was very quiet at the weekend, though.
Yeah, but do more players need some of that treatment? Have they just been relying on the same guys for too long? I don't know.
And the emotional high and fall of the World Cup, Sam, like, as you said, that was a journey, that was their destiny.
I know it was. It was just crushing. I thought that was crushing for the tournament when they went out. And the players are going to feel that. If I felt it, it's just a punter and a neutral. Like, if you're a French, flipping it, that must have been a massive crushing blow. I just wonder whether there is a bit of a hangover from that. Because we've seen it in the club game as well.
Well, that's where this weekend is just so fascinating. I know that the Sunday game feels more predictable. But those two on Saturdays, like what Wales are you going to get? What England are you going to get? We'll talk England next. But John, Scotland can put France out the title race on Saturday. But if Scotland lose, then they're almost certainly out of title race, because with all the will in the world, they've got to go to Dublin where their record's horrific and, you know, yeah, while anyone wins in Dublin. So what a game that is. And it's what a chance for Scotland to not only knock France out of the title race. And the answer to my question, who's going to stop Ireland? With the way the fixtures are falling, it might have to be on Scotland here.
I think the challenge has been for Scotland. Someone said, what's success for Scotland? And I don't know if they're good enough to be Ireland. And I don't think many teams are in Ireland. If what we saw at the weekend, and we take out that New Zealand game at the World Cup, I just look at the weekend and you look at what's coming after that. They've got Italy away and England at home, and then they've got to go to Ireland last weekend. And it does kind of feel like the challenge for Scotland has always been, how do we close the gap on France and Ireland? And that's the challenge for Wales, it's a challenge for England, challenge for Italy to a certain extent. How do we close that gap? I think if Scotland can win on the weekend, which will be a huge challenge, we're one game in, so we don't know whether this is a pattern, a downward spiral for France. It seems a bit premature to say that, but a win on Saturday puts Scotland in a great position. But then they've got England to come to town. Are Italy going to win a game this year? They're showing enough intent, enough attack in their game.
That may have been their best chance.
Yeah, potentially.
Against hello England.
Yeah, this weekend feels huge for Scottish rugby.
I tell you, this is not a comment off the reaction of what we saw on Friday night, but I've been nervous from a French perspective about going to Murrayfield for a couple of weeks now. Scotland have this unbelievable ability of perhaps picking up these one-off games which no one gives them that much of a chance. Well, you won out in France a couple of years ago, wasn't it? When no one, and I know it was slightly different because France were playing fast and loose towards the end of the game, then Duane van der Merwe goes over, scores a try. But the Scottish team I saw in that first half, and I can't measure that against the French team which we saw on Friday night, because I'm hoping that's an anomaly. But I do think the Scotland team have enough to create so many opportunities and cause all manner of problems to France. If I was Galtier or Sean Edwards, you're going to get a massive reaction, but it might not be enough. It's so hard to be able to categorise and understand where this French side are right now, but you don't want to fully commit to a narrative based on one 80-minute performance, because the last 2.5 years have shown this French side to be pretty decent, and they've certainly not dropped 20% because the one player, Antoine Dupont, is missing. I think we'll know...
Maybe 15.
We'll know so much more about where 100%. This Scotland team are that rapidly get excited about their opportunity within the Six Nations after round one. That's just what happens. Like, that's just a fact.
Well, do you want them to say they're not going to win?
Sorry?
Do you want them to say they're not going to win?
No. I mean,
no, I love watching these two from across the table go at each other.
Because I'm pretty sure after winning two games in a row last year, Duane van der Merwe said, we're going to win the World Cup.
Yeah, but he's not very smart.
Yeah, well, he said it.
No, he didn't.
No, he said it to Lee McKenzie.
Oh, well, yeah, but he's. That's not the voice of a team.
I sympathise.
That's not the voice of a team. And I think you've got
to. You meant to play yourself down from the camp.
We're in the middle of a Six Nations, we're 9 months from World Cup.
Oh, yeah, I think talking about World Cup, but yeah, that was probably not the right approach. But they've got to, Scotland have to talk like they can beat France.
Yeah, of course,
They beat England loads recently, and then they're 3-3.
All the belief in Scotland that they can beat France. And they should be, because they're good enough to beat them.
100%. Just on England to finish, Hughes, I said, you know, Italy had a chance against callow England. Callow is probably the wrong word, because there were 13 of the World Cup 23. But with the five debutants, it was new, it's evolving. England have got Wales next, then 2 weeks to Murrayfield. Mm-hmm. By that point, they'd have had 5 weeks in camp, but they've got to get Wales done first.
Yeah.
Do you see enough to beat Wales?
Yes.
And were you encouraged? Were you not encouraged? Where were you after being in Rome?
It's a win.
Or hard to say.
I didn't feel, honestly, it took me a while to try to work out the emotion. It's the first win away. First round one win for 5 years, already mentioned that. I don't know. I was happy but not satisfied. To be outscored by Italy is not ideal. You look at the numbers, the statistics. England had the quickest ruck speed across the three matches. They also had the most entries into the 22, but scored the joint fewest amount of tries. So it seems a little bit deja vu in terms of the problem area, just been better in attack. I did say before the game, I wanted to measure England on their intent, and there was plenty of that. It was never going to be fully connected when you got slightly different combinations. I think they really missed an Ollie Lawrence-type figure. I thought Fraser Dingwall was very tidy at the weekend, but having that central focus seems to be so important. Sort of Bundiaki did on Friday night. But defensively, it was a massive contrast first half to second half. They were disjointed in the first half. Second half, it felt like Felix Jones just went in at half-time. Was like, guys, I need you to fully commit to this. Get off the line. When you get off the line, you're basically... The challenge to the opposition is, how good are you under pressure? How quick are your skills? Ball handling. And they challenged Italy, and at times they negated their ability. But three runaway tries for Italy, that would be something that would sting and hurt me and want to fix. But yeah, a positive start quite clearly to it. But you're just hoping we can see so much more this weekend.
I thought that they did enough and they came back into the game. I think the defence, and you guys see a bit more of the Premiership than I did, there's probably no team in the Gallagher Premiership that plays that style of defence.
Exeter do.
Okay, but
they fly off the line.
But it's something that takes a long time to get good at. And when I think the problem with this really fast-pressed, aggressive line speed is that when you get it wrong, everyone's offline and the opposition flood through you and there's not much recovery time. And you saw that the tries were actually relatively easy. When they got in behind, it was pass, score. And we talked about it on Rugby Special before this. You could have found 20 clips. And as an attacking coach reviewing that from an Italy point of view, I don't know if they maybe expected that. That's the challenge. They maybe didn't know. All the teams know now that England would be happy to leave half a pitch, and whether they'll change that slightly, and maybe they're just getting used to that system. They're going to leave half a pitch and the best teams in the world can get the ball there better. And then how do you recover from that? So that would be a concern for me. But yeah, I think it's hard. Italy's a hard place to go and play now. And Italy have improved vastly. Their attacking skills, their game management improved. They weren't shooting themselves in the foot like they did so much last year. But yeah, like you say, they're off the board, good win, and they'll learn a lot in terms of, like, you know, you do training drills, especially around defence. So I'll finish in a second. But you think you've got this blitz defence, and even if you do it live in training, it's not the same thing. Mm-hmm. You're going to learn so much from that game of guys about the system. What did I do wrong? How do we make this system better? And it, like you said, it looked like it was a real buy-in, and you need complete buy-in in that system.
I'm looking at the Wales-England game, like, two ways. If you said to me, can Wales keep England, given their limited attack? It's been fairly limited, I think it's fair to say. If you say, can Wales keep England? England's attack looked to be fairly limited. You know, it's improving somewhat, but fairly limited. Not, you wouldn't say it's always potent attack. If you say, can Wales keep England to two tries in Twickenham? I'd be like, potentially, if Wales are good on it. I think if you say, can Wales score more than two tries in Twickenham? Can they score three? I'd be like, well, yeah, they could. So I think there is the potential for the upset. But then you look at history, and like in the past 24 years, Wales have only won in Twickenham in 2008 and 2012 as the last victory. Both of those were Grand Slam teams. So they're very good Welsh teams have won away in Twickenham. And I don't want to say average, that's probably disrespectful, but a team that's not a Grand Slam team to go to Twickenham and win, history just says is very difficult, which is why I'm swaying towards England. They've got the potential to, but I think it's going to be a very difficult game for Wales.
The other positive for me at the weekend, couple were the young fellas, debutants.
Cunningham South
and his potential, his raw potential. The energy those young fellas brought on Saturday, I thought was tremendous. And also for Steve Borthwick, five new debutants into the side, the most we've seen since 2012. When you try and knit in that lack of experience into a team that is going through a slight transition with figureheads missing, I know everyone is, it is going to feel slightly clunky, but I was so impressed with how well they did. And a guy that would almost feel like it is almost the debut again, Tommy Freeman on the wing.
I like it. I thought he was
the best player on the pitch. I know Ethan Root's got player of the match, but Tommy Freeman, this marauding winger, he's big, he's powerful, he's quick, and he wants the ball in his hand. He goes hunting for it. And the way in which he hit the line, which you analyse in Rugby Special, to put where Elliot Daly was class. So those clutch of players, I think, when the England boys go back into camp and these young fellas were like, oh my word, I've just made my debut in the Six Nations, in front of my friends and family, that feel-good factor almost overrides any sense of frustration they may have felt through a performance.
Would you make any changes going into the Wales game?
Ellis Genge will be back fit for this, so what they do with him or Benno Urbano on the bench, he pulled out last week with a slight foot problem, but I very much doubt there will be any changes. The only one I would like to see get some game time at some point, and this might sound harsh on Freddie Stewart because he's rock solid. And in fact, he was player of the match last year, wasn't he, at the Principality? And Wales are going to come with a high kick pressure game. George Furbank, just as an option at the back, I think he is such an exceptional player.
Great stuff, guys. Sam, we've got a pod with you coming out this week, all about England-Wales, talking through some of those times you ransacked Twickenham, 2012, for example. So it does happen.
And it wasn't all the glory days for Wales. We talk about some defeats as well. So it's not too pro-Welsh, hopefully.
But that is on the daily next few days. What an opening weekend, guys, quickly, because we've got a couple of minutes left. Moment of the weekend, try of the weekend, player of the weekend.
Ooh, player McCarthy.
Yeah. He's big Joe McCarthy. He announced himself, didn't he? Well, I know he's been around for a bit, but that was big.
I think he's the missing piece.
Yeah,
I think domestically and internationally, there's been a perception you can get at Ireland physically, and McCarthy was like, nah, not anymore. Not anymore.
I'm not going to try and think of something different. I think it's been the player, similar with Leinster when they get to Europe, it's the one thing that they get challenged with when they come up against big La Rochelle packs or Sarries when they're at their peak. Same with Ireland. People argue they come unstuck up front. I think he could be that enforcer-style player that Ireland have been desperately missing for the last few years, which will scarily take him to another level again.
I agree. Joe McCarthy, I think he's ridiculous. Against the big, heavy pack, we spoke about it in Rugby Special, he's not playing against a lightweight pack. He was... dynamic, he's powerful, he's fit for a big man, he keeps going, he's got a big engine. Yeah, he was quality. He's still so young, so he just offers him something slightly different to what they get from the other second. And just again, just adds even more ridiculous depth to this Ireland squad.
What about you, Chris?
Aaron Wainwright. I mean, Aaron Wainwright is kind of my moment and player.
He was
just
good.
Because he kind of had like a physical transplant at halftime, didn't he? Yeah. Or a mental, like the whole Welsh team, they had a complete... He suddenly was taking kickoffs and just run. And it made you think that for all you guys have been in high performance environments where everything is probably, you know, stripped down to a T and game plans and schedules and it's all really scientific. But there's an art to this and it just can come down to just emotion, belief, confidence, the intangibles. And he kind of summed it up for Wales in that second half.
I think it's nice from a Welsh perspective to know that there's life after Tarupe Faletau. I think that's the one thing that Welsh fans have been wondering.
There's the how much it can be just about mental, about approach. And that's why I was so impressed by Ireland, because everything about Marseille was setting up for a French onslaught and they weathered it and they played their game despite what was an absolute cauldron. So much to get at. What a weekend.
Question, are we going to get a Grand Slam this year?
Oh, I mean, it's got to be Ireland, doesn't it?
No. Is there going to be a Grand Slam this year?
Yeah, Ireland win the Slam now. Ireland win the Slam now, don't they? Well, someone's got to take them out. Someone's got to do something about them.
No offence.
Hugo, say what you're thinking. He thinks England are going to do it.
Oh, England Slam.
No.
I know, imagine.
No. I did say England Slam, but... Game week 4.
That is a big game.
That's when last year I thought England might nick it against France at Twickenham.
Who have they got game 4?
Ireland.
In
Twickenham.
Okay. The reason I agree is England can hit, and I've said this a few times, England can hit an emotional peak that you just know when they're on, they've got the ability to be on. They've always got that in the locker. And that's why, I know I'm Welsh, so I shouldn't be too pro-English, but you know that big performances there. Yep. And at home, if it was away, I'd be like, no. Yep. But at home, there's potential.
But they've got Wales and Scotland. And Scotland, I still think this. There's a danger this could be an Irish procession already. You look at fascinating fixtures, absolutely. Scotland, France, awesome. England, Wales, awesome. Mm-hmm. England up at Murrayfield, awesome. England home to Ireland, awesome. Ireland home to Scotland. So much to get at. Great stuff, guys.
We'll do Wales. We'll do Scots.
So you've had to deal with all day with this clown. He's on one.
Because Arsenal won. Come on, the boys.
Daily's out tomorrow and the next day, basically forever. See you soon.
Cheers.
Cheers, Jonesy. Cheers.
On the Football Daily Podcast.
The Women's Football Weekly.
With me, Ellen White.
Ellen White coming forward.
And me, Ben Haynes, with some of the biggest names in the WSL joining us every week to discuss everything that's happening in the women's game.
Right after the World Cup, got told, we're going to America. I thought, amazing. 10 days into training, did my meniscus, and the next day they flew to America.
Blocked header 6 yards out, Ellen White!
The Women's Football Weekly Podcast.
New episodes every Wednesday.
Subscribe to the Football Daily on BBC Sounds.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.